Hey everybody, and welcome to VOK Mindhunter Season 1. We're going to be taking an in-depth look today at the first season of the Netflix series Mindhunter, starring Jonathan Groff, Holt McCallaway as Holder Ford, and Bill Tench, two FBI elite serial crime unit personnel. With me today, I have Bina 007.
Hey everyone.
Fresh off a win in whatever game he was playing, FT Ward.
Hi, C'Thun Warrior in Hearthstone. I actually drew C'Thun before I lost. It was quite nice. I'm Thomas on the real life.
We have Tadana.
Data, didn't win anything today.
That's all right. And Hannah.
It's Shadow Baby, always winning.
All right, guys, so this is Netflix continuing to crush it with their independent series. We previewed Wormwood a couple weeks ago, and now we're doing this, Mindhunter. What do you guys think? Let's give ratings in high-heeled shoes.
I'm getting 5 high-heeled shoes. Oh, wow. I really loved it. I thought it was better than Wormwood. Wormwood, like pacing and was a bit dodgy, whereas this one really was captivating. It was slow to get into. I love the way David Fincher frames a scene. I'm a big Fincher fan. So, like, it's Fincher plus serial killers. It was going to be hard for me not to love this. So, I'm all about it.
Yeah, I guess I would give it something like a 4.33 or something like that. I very, very much liked it. I thought the first time I watched it, I found the dialogue in the early episodes kind of forced and not natural. But on my rewatch, I did not have the same issue. So I very, very, very much liked it. And like Bina said, when I saw the trailer, I knew I was going to. So I was not disappointed in any way.
Dana?
Easily 4.5. I really enjoyed it. I was surprised I enjoyed it when I first saw the trailer. I rolled my eyes and went, oh, great, another series glorifying FBI profiling. And then I watched it, and I was completely and utterly wrong. And I think it was fantastic. And I think Fincher should do every movie set in the 70s because he does it so well.
And hey, Dana, do you want to tell the listeners a bit about your background and why you're particularly, you know, qualified in terms of the FBI profiling kind of stuff?
Who's squeezing a bag?
He's basically rubbing their face against a balloon right now.
I'm on mute.
That might be my piercings rubbing against my headphones. Give me a sec.
Okay.
Okay. Dana, do you want to hold off on that and we could get Hannah's?
Sounds good. Sorry.
Okay. Hannah, what do you think?
I give it 5 pairs of the largest high heel shoes they have in the store. I fucking love them.
Excellent.
I love Fincher, and I'm obsessed with The Zodiac Killer. My copy of Zodiac by Robert Graysman is almost worn out. It's a paperback copy. I love his movie, and I love how much of the same style carried over in this show. It just works for what it is, and I don't know any better way to describe it than that. It's just this subtle technique that he has, and the use of colors and things that, I don't know, they're like drab and vibrant at the same time, and it speaks to me. I think it really portrays what it's probably like in the mind of some of these people. It's just the way he shoots stuff, and perfect casting, I think, across the board. I loved it.
I agree, and let's not forget Fincher can do horror. Think of Seven, and there's that scene near the end with Kemper where you are petrified for the agent.
And oh my god! And,
but it's not
every
like
scene with Kemper.
Horrific.
I'm like, this is it. This is where he stabs him with like his handcuffs. Like,
and I think I think there's formal things that Fincher does with framing and holding a shot in someone's face and building tension in a very subtle way that is just brilliant.
It's almost very film noirish, isn't it? I don't know. His use of colors is just fascinating. Anyway.
Yeah, I think his ability to build tension is amazing. I mean, I think those scenes with Wendy Carr giving tuna fish to the cat are just so
tense. Oh my goodness.
So oh my God. Scary. She was about to get grabbed through the wall. That entire time, I was just like, here it comes.
Yeah. I thought she was going to be a victim of something because she's like doing this routine and it's, oh my God. And then the ants in the can. That's happened to me before. Like, it was so scary.
I think the scenes with Tench and his wife and his family scenes, there's nothing goes on in them, but they're so tense that you just, like, it's unbelievable how he builds tension. And then I'm thinking of the scene where the brother, the sister-in-law, and her husband all kill the one woman. And then the sister-in-law comes, I guess the sister comes to the police station with her baby. And for a second, I'm like, is the baby dead? I mean, everything is just so rich with tension in the whole series. It's really, really well done for television. It's amazing.
Yeah, and I think I'd give it like a – sorry, just so we could just get done with these ratings and then go into the show a little more. We're already off the rails. I'd give it a 4.5 out of 5 high heels because just as everyone's saying, visually is very beautiful. The story and the subject matter obviously is something that pertains to my interests, and just the way the characters interacted, I really think that Jonathan Groff and his girlfriend interacted in a very like, I don't know if it was tension or if it was another kind of discomfort, but there always seemed to be a weird kind of relationship between them where it was like kind of I think he viewed it as almost somewhat deviant, but like was trying to normalize it. I don't know what was going on. Anyway, I really enjoyed it. And okay, now we can talk more about it.
Sorry.
Or not.
With the tension. I don't normally have physical reactions to things that movies and TV make me feel, but this was so tense I actually ended up with stomach cramps just because.
Holy shit.
I don't know. Because I had no idea it would be that tense. Like Zodiac wasn't that tense. It kept you intrigued and it was a very long film, but especially at that the Last Kemper scene, I totally get why he had even more of a breakdown after, because I was hyperventilating through that. It was just so insanely well done that I can't believe that someone can shoot and write and act and do something that makes me have a physical reaction like that. That just, you know, when you feel tense in real life, it's fantastic. Madame Tussaud's 4D's got nothing on this shit.
Oh, yeah. Do you want to tell people why you're qualified to be specifically critical of behavioral science and stuff like this?
I am completely and utterly unqualified because I'm technically not a psychologist. No, I have a degree in psychology and I've done criminology units as well. So while I would have to do my master's to say that I'm qualified to do this, I do get very frustrated at the... Yeah. I think FBI profiling had its place, and now we have computers, and they do it better. So we should stop making people be the computers, because FBI profilers were essentially just taking in large amounts of information and being able to look at it and give you, apply it to a case. This is the formation of this. You see them take in all these cases for the first time, like across state lines, which couldn't exist in the 70s, 80s, or even for most of the 90s. But now we have computers and they take the human element out, which is, why they probably shouldn't be glorified as much as they are now. And the FBI are moving that way as well and have moved that way for a very long period of time. It's just this human element that makes mistakes. And I think we'll probably see that in the future as well, because I know the season 2 being the Atlanta serial killer, they fucked up big time. Especially Douglas, who Holden Ford is based on. Also, Holden Ford, ridiculous a name. Do not name your main character over 2 car brands. Sorry.
So let's talk about a little bit of what you were just saying as the advances, you know, this is covering a period of time where it was, you know, motive and, you know, the way to kind of solve these crimes were very set in stone. Like, you know, who had the motive, who had the opportunity, and who had, what was the third one? Someone help me.
It's means, motive, and opportunity.
Means,
right?
Motive, and, yeah. So, now they're trying to break that mold, and there was resistance within the FBI that they depicted within the series. And I think that there's going to be, as Dana just talked about, there's going to be resistance going to a completely computational model. I know that in biomedical research, they want to do the same thing, but there's still need for that personal wet lab field research work that needs to be done to be able to get the information to put into the computers. So were you guys surprised that, you know, that the FBI seemed resistant to exploring, you know, a new type of, you know, profiling or psychology to criminality?
No, because it's still a civil service bureaucracy and people are always resistant to change. Like, I don't think it's specific to just us. Didn't surprise me. And, you know, they're right to be, because the protagonist does do stuff that's a little bit unethical, immoral, pushes it too far. So, you know.
Yeah, I wasn't surprised. I mean, as an institution, the FBI for a long time was J. Edgar Hoover, and he was quite resistant to doing anything that would even possibly put the FBI in any kind of bad light. So I think that was a strong institutional bias they had to overcome even to get to where they got.
I think Hoover just wanted the FBI to not know about psychology, because then they would have known about Hoover.
yeah, psychology and the mafia, yeah, the FBI didn't need to know.
And I also think that there's also good reason for supervisors to not want people going out and getting their hands dirty in this way, because you have no idea how someone's going to react. You know, you're putting them in a dangerous situation, just not physically, but emotionally and mentally, and whatever they can learn, what happens, especially because you've never had anyone to do this before, if they come out so damaged by the end, what good is the information? Because they can no longer interpret it. You know, that whole thing of if you look at something, it will turn you crazy. It's essentially the psych version of that hypothetical. You could end up throwing so many young, bright things at this problem and just decimate that population, and you don't have them for the future. And they didn't know that. They didn't know how people were going to react to having to deal with serial killers, and serial rapists and necrophilia and all that goes along with that for hours and days and months and years at a time. And interviewing them takes days as well. So it's, yeah, sending someone to that would not be an easy decision.
I think they sum up the, like, mentality of the time really well when they go to that Midwest police station and they're talking about, like, if Manson walked in here right now, I'd shoot him in the face and not think twice about it. It's just trying to treat these people like anything but animals, I think, would be a really hard pill to swallow. And then it's a time where, sure, there was Freud and psychology was around, but it was either still really not mainstream and not really embraced widespread. And where it was also easily, like, weird. You know what I mean? Like, you have a lot of stories from back then where the therapist is like, you need to be more sexual. We're going to have an orgy in my office and stuff. And so I think, like, the whole nation hadn't embraced this field of science yet.
That's very particular, you know, Freud and Jung. But, you know, I think this was the development of the beginning of, like, forensic psychology and criminology. So let's, do we want to move forward? And can I just say that one of the doctors that helped Douglas and Ressler was Dr. Ann Burgess, and she's local, and I want to look her up so bad. pick her brain about this time. She's a professor, or she was a professor over at BC. So is there anything else that you guys want to talk about? And I guess maybe I should record a disclaimer separately, but we're going to be talking about some pretty sick shit, and we're going to, you know, go into detail of it and maybe have a real discussion about it, maybe have a little fun with it. But we do realize that obviously that there are real victims to what we're about to talk about, and we're not trying to minimize anyone's suffering or loss.
And also just exercise self-care as a listener. Listening to this stuff is not for everyone, so be advised.
Could we talk a little bit more just about how beautiful the entire series was? Because I'm new to Fincher, so I'm still gobsmacked.
My wife is from Pennsylvania. I've dated a few women from Pennsylvania, and this is basically Pennsylvania.
Yep. From the very first shot, I'm born and raised in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
Literally the first second of the first shot, it's like, this is Pittsburgh. And then it comes up on the screen, Braddock, Pennsylvania. And the whole series, I think, is most, if not entirely, filmed in Western Pennsylvania and around. And it just felt like home to me so much. Yeah. It was just lovely.
And Braddock's right outside Pittsburgh. And I think maybe like a day or two after I watched that episode, I was watching this food show and they're trying to do like a farm to table, like pop up in Braddock, Pennsylvania. I was like, where the fuck did I just hear that sound? It's like, oh, very different stories going on here. Two different programs.
Yeah. I think what's really interesting about the look of it is they used two cinematographers on the series. And one of them, Christopher Probst, is a guy who's done a lot of music videos, stuff like Taylor Swift, whatever. But I think that does kind of teach you a certain polish and a certain formality with how you want things to look on screen. And then the other cinematographer, he's called Eric Messerschmidt. He has done tons of big kind of action movies like Ant-Man, Fantastic Four, Gone Girl he did. And I think, again, it's kind of like an interesting combination of technical skill they bring to it, because it does feel like a movie. It's filmed in 4K. I've seen it on my boyfriend's projector, so projected really big, and it looks as good as anything David Fincher has done as a feature film. It's just stunning.
And extensive CGI, with all the cinematography and all that kind of thing, but to make it look 1970s, he must have the biggest file of just what the 1970s was.
That is Western Pennsylvania today.
Yeah, we haven't. Once the steel mills crashed, a lot of places haven't really changed since the 70s.
Yeah.
Well, there are a few shots of how much they had to green screen for certain streets, I think, and buildings, but I guess there would be a lot of sets that they could use just. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry, Pennsylvania. I didn't know.
No, I mean, Pittsburgh itself is quite healthy, but there are neighborhoods that were, like Braddock, for example. I haven't been there in a long time, but Braddock, it's just sad. I mean, the town just died, basically.
Yeah, Pittsburgh is like one of the big hubs of like bioengineering with Carnegie Mellon and University of Pittsburgh there. Yeah. But yeah, Western Pennsylvania is very tired. They're very the old coal, steel mines, stuff like that. But it looks exactly, if you drive through like Bethlehem or like the Lehigh Valley, there's towns that look exactly like, you know, the towns that they're driving through.
It's interesting to me, like the production designer hasn't worked with Fincher before. I thought maybe he would have worked on Zodiac or something, but he's the same guy who does House of Cards, which is such a different modern, sleek, luxurious look. It's kind of interesting, one to the other.
So does everyone in the BSU have vitamin D deficiency because they're expected to work underground? I thought that was really weird.
From the book, I guess it's the Quantico is a marine base, as well as having the FBI training and stuff on it, and as a military facility, you have to build, I guess, if you build like a 6-story building, you have to build 6 stories underground. So when they're in the basement, they're literally like 5 or 6 stories underground, and they have to like go to the library or something if they want to see sunlight. And that's one thing Douglas talks about quite a bit in the book, is he just had to get out of there a lot of times because it was driving people crazy.
So do we want to go into, can you give us more examples about the book where it either stays true, the series stays true to the book, or differs, or anything that really stood out to you, Thomas?
Sure. I mean, the Bill Tench character is what's the word I'm looking for? It's not a single character. It's wrestler, certainly, but it's a composition character of a bunch of characters. And the Jonathan, the Holden Ford character, Aller, is clearly based on Douglas, but is also quite different. Douglas is, I think, married with children at this time. So I think they've changed all those so they can explore some things in their characters that if they just said it was John Douglas, I don't think they'd be able to do the kind of make the Ford character's kind of action so questionable and kind of interesting. So that's quite a bit different, the two characters. And then a lot of the cases where it puts them in the room with the, I'm thinking like The Rock, where the majorette is murdered. They're really just, sorry, I'm having trouble thinking of words, but they're just, they're helping out the local authorities. They're not actually in the room during the interviews and stuff like that. A lot of times they're just getting the information from their contacts throughout the country. And then they're advising them on how they would set up an interview, whether they would or would not polygraph someone. So all those are quite different. And I think it's better for the show that they expand their presence and their actual positions in those cases, as opposed to just having them advise on that stuff. And I'm trying to think of what other major differences. You know, I again, the characters are quite different, and I think that works better for a drama. Douglas comes off as kind of an ass in the book, I think, but he's a different kind of ass than old Ford comes off as. And the book is pretty short. It's made 350 pages, and it's interesting. I would definitely recommend, if you're interested in this kind of stuff, checking it out. And do we know for certain that the second season is the Atlanta child murders?
It's been greenlit. I don't know exactly what the overall story arc is going to be.
So that should be very interesting to see what cases they go into further. Because I think for a lot of the interview stuff with former serial killers, I imagine that's mostly in the past, and that was one of my favorite parts of the first season, certainly. So I'll be interested to see where we go going forward.
I think they continue to interview them to this day, actually, as it's just more information and that kind of thing. So I guess they'll always have people to interview.
Does that happen in other countries, Dana? Does it happen in England and other places? Like, is this just a normal thing people do, or is this like a very FBI specific thing? Do you know?
I assume England does it, or Britain does it, because the Moore murders, either they didn't or they did. But they were involved in trying to interview them because they were interesting, because they were a couple murderer, and understanding that, because then there was links to the West Australian Bernie's case, and they were another couple murder, serial murder couple, sorry. But they do still try to interview them because, yeah, it's just more information about why, how people meet, why they do it. And the more information, I guess, the safer other people are. But I think it might depend on funding and that kind of thing, because it's a bit hard not to get to get information if you're not attached to a uni or something. I'm not at university anymore, so I really struggled to find journal articles and that kind of thing, because
and it's funny because when they got their grant for $385,000, I was like, holy shit. Because in the late, in the, what was it, early 70s, late 70s, mid 70s? Like, typically 1 year of funding for biomedical research as a big project is $250,000 in today's money. Like, $385,000 back then, that's a absurd amount of money to fund basically three salaries and travel.
Yeah. Who was skimming off the top?
Yeah, right?
But did they must have had other research. I mean, we see three people. There must have been a team of junior research staff who were arranging notes and typing stuff up. No? I mean, for that amount of money?
Right.
Yeah, I think the behavioral sciences unit, before they even get there, is larger. There's more people in it. And like I said, the Tench character is kind of a composite of several agents.
So
did they just inflate it for our...
Like, no,
idea
I don't
money?
Think so.
So,
no, because I mean, they got about a normal grant from one entity, and another entity wanted to
compete, yeah,
compete with them. So, they got an almost similar amount so that both people would end up having their name in involvement. Stranger things have happened.
No, I have a lot of friends in academia. That is the strangest thing that's ever happened. They got money.
Yeah. It takes a lot.
I was just going to say about interviewing them, like Ed Kemper and Monty Russell are still alive. And I think it's important to continue monitoring how, like, what their progress is through their life behind bars. Do they ever, like, David Berkowitz is also still alive and claims to be a completely changed man.
Well, he's a Christian and so now. Monty,
and so does Monty Russell. They claim to be completely reformed. David Berkowitz has a very strong position on the fact that he was completely possessed. That's not at all who he is. He can't fathom it. He hates the name Son of Sam. And I think it's important to continue monitoring whether that's real, trying to gauge if it's just a further manipulation, as we know these people are master manipulators, or can you grow out of it? So I think there's still work to be done.
I completely agree, and I think that's probably happening because we have them as a resource, and if, you know, we can offer them whatever, you know, I'm sure there's some kind of carrot that, you know, people that are in academia that need to study them, or just, you know, the FBI, or just the correctional institutions that they're in. I'm sure that they monitor them regularly. I'd hope so, but I'd hope that access would be open also to scholars and researchers.
But, yeah, I mean, I think even forensic psychology, I think there's more to it just beyond the crime, how it happened, when it happened. I think traveling along the road of their lifetime with these people, you know, some of them get murdered in prison, some of them are executed, but the ones that we still have alive that are willing and able to talk, they have more to offer in this field that can be applied. Just, you know, the point is to apply it to prevent crime.
Well, I'll get into it a little bit
still more there
when I talk about Kemper, but the more that you have, the longer that you have these people in jail, the more that, you know, either they reflect, their stories change. That, like, I'll bring up two examples when I do Kemper, but his stories changed drastically as far as pathos. So, like you said, they're master manipulators. So how much can you get from re-interviewing these people over and over again? You know, I don't know at what point that information becomes not helpful.
Is it like a human rights and kind of like, you know, how many times, I don't want to cast aspersions on researchers, but the novelty of doing it, like how much are they really going to get that's new? And God, I can't believe I'm speaking for the human rights of serial killers who are in prison, but at what point does it become just exploitation? Let's go talk to the freak.
Yeah. Which is fair.
And at what point do you want to continue to give them that attention? People like Kemper were feeding off that. That's what they wanted, and they don't care where they get the attention from. They don't care if they're on TV because they don't have, well, now they have massive access to TVs and that kind of thing. But all attention is good attention when you're going to be in prison for your entire life. So you don't want to give that to them.
One of my favorite parts of the series is when they bring pizza to Ed Kemper and he's like, pizza! Just like, you know, anything that gets you out of the routine of being in jail, I'm sure is just amazing.
Right. I mean, I think it sits a lot more comfortably to me having, you know, forensic psychologists come in and want to talk to them about their, you know, in Kemper's words, work, you know, their projects, than it does to have people writing them fan letters or trying to fucking marry them. Like, that is just so sick to me and should be, like, not allowed at all. So I think it's really important. Like, Dr. Michael Stone is a really famous forensic psychologist who his whole life's work is about creating a scale of evil. So he examines not just serial killers, but all kinds of violent criminals.
Yeah, I've seen his stuff. I'm not entirely convinced about his definitions, but I mean, I would love to talk about that in a separate episode because I think we could probably do an entire episode on that.
Oh, and I would love to too. I'm a huge fan, but you know, I just think it's still important. And yeah, I mean, you should. You know, the first step to winning any battle is knowing your enemy, right? So the more you can know from them, even if their story changes, even if they are manipulating you, it's still an observable behavior that you can collect data from. And the more data you have, I do think the more, you know, insights and deductions you'll be able to gain from it. Even if it's repetitive, you know, there's patterns that can be observed and stuff.
Yeah. And I think that Bina and I talked about this because I recommended a book to her, The Monster of Florence, where the Italian.
Oh, I love that book so much. I read that like as quickly as I could, given that I had work in between. Great book.
So the Italian Carabinieri or whatever their names are, they had to refer to the FBI to try to get a profile on them because they didn't have this kind of behavioral unit. You know, they were still going on, well, politics mostly, but, you know, the old MMO of means, motive, and opportunity. So I don't know if, you know, I was trying to explain that that it seems like serial killing is a majority American kind of, but, you know, there's, of course, exceptions.
If you stick to killing drug-addicted prostitutes and dumping them in places where they can't find their bodies, there's a good chance you won't get caught even now.
Good to know.
Sorry, that sounds really depressing, but especially if you are a vulnerable person of color. If people don't know you're missing, then they're not going to search. So it tends to why you see this, and it's why they occasionally in the news they'll be like, hey, we just found 20 bodies and we don't know why. Yeah. And this really terrifies us. It's why you see serial killers or murders pop up when there's high migrant populations moving in, or so, if there's been a natural disaster or anything like that.
So they moving off that thought, Dana.
Sorry.
No problem. So one of the things that happens during the show is that they come up with the word serial killer, right? And that has a very different definition than a mass murderer or a serial murderer. And I guess do you want to talk about that in a little way? Because I feel like there's a lot of people that have killed lots of people due to drugs, due to you know, the or within the organization of managing prostitutes, drugs, whatever, other criminality, there are other people that have, like, obviously, like, we just had a mass shooting in America again, that aren't, that don't have that, you know, I guess, ritual that most serial killers seem to have.
Sure, do we want to let Hannah, do we want to let Hannah do Monty Riss real quick, so in case she has to bow out?
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay, so we'll do Monty Rissell, and do you want to introduce him as he was in the series and what you found out?
Yeah, I guess. I mostly just wrote things up on him in real life. So I don't know. I'll just go off what I
whatever narrative you came up with.
Okay. So Monty Rissell is kind of fascinating, but unfortunately, there's just really little out there on him that I found. I actually can't find any video footage of him in real life, and I looked really hard for many hours. He was born in Alexandria, Virginia, which is less than 40 miles from Quantico. He was an active rapist from age 14. He's about 59 years old now and still carrying out his five consecutive life sentences. He was a high school dropout who lived with his mother. And we know for sure that he committed his first rape when he was 14. He was picked up on like petty burglary and placed in an institution. He was granted temporary release at one point thereafter and committed another rape. Some of the stuff I found says that he may have committed as many as 12 rapes prior to his first killing, but I couldn't really find any confirmation. There's a lot of different numbers that get thrown around with him, and I can't tell if that's police attributing it to him or him claiming more, and the story kind of keeps changing, so there's a lot of conflicting data. He says that he was angry on the night of August 4th, 1976, because he had had a girlfriend and caught a glimpse of her with her new boyfriend. He was drinking in his automobile and smoking marijuana outside of his apartment complex that he shared with a 26-year-old prostitute by the name of Wara Marina Gaber. And Rissell decides to carjack her and rape her. He claims that he ended up killing her because she allowed him to have sex with her. And to me, this is just one of the most tragic ones because it's got to be some sort of on-the-job instinct she's picked up. And she's, you know, if his story, if his accounting of it is true, it's probably a survivalist technique she'd picked up somewhere along the way. And unfortunately, in this particular instance, it didn't help her out. So he claims that he wouldn't have killed her if it hadn't been for that. And we can't say for sure. Maybe, maybe not. There's also mixed information about this particular murder. In the show, he says that he tangled with her and fell down a ravine. I've heard other accounts that he threw her down the ravine. She wasn't dead. He goes down after her, strangles her with her own bra. She's still not dead. Then he picks up a rock, bashes her skull in, and for good measure drowns her in the water at the end of this ravine. But the order of those events and which ones are actually true is also sort of unclear from the research I've managed to do. He goes on to later in the year, his second victim, McDonald's manager, Ursula Miltenberger, who lives in Holmes Run Apartments. He'll actually pick up more victims from there. I believe his next two victims are from the same hunting ground, basically. This is when he sort of changes his MO. He stabs her rather than bludgeoning or strangulation or drowning, and leaves her body out in the woods to be discovered several days later. Apparently, according to the show, he had another victim either before his next or right after his next that he decided to let live. I can't find anything that confirms this in real life. I read an article, but I think they were going off data from the show, more or less. And again, it's because she said her father was dying of cancer. His brother had cancer, so he just rapes her rather than raping and murdering her. Shows her mercy. The next victim is Gladys Bradley, a post office clerk. And again, she is stabbed with a steak knife from his own mother's kitchen. But he also rapes her multiple times and drowns her for good measure as well. So he is sort of developing now a pattern of stabbing and water being involved. His fourth victim, Jeanette McClelland, she was found to be sexually assaulted. The fourth victim, Jeanette McClelland, she was a 24-year-old resident of the same Holmes Run Apartments. They found her sexually assaulted. She'd been stabbed more than two dozen times and found in a culvert off the highway. And his final victim before apprehension was a little bit older, and her name was Althea Byrd. It's not sure when exactly she went missing, sometime in early April, but her body was not found until middle of May. She had also been stabbed repeatedly and left found in the woods. This is when they actually managed to bring Russell in. He returns to the scene of his crimes, and he has trophies on him. He's got Bird's wallet, her keys, and her comb. And I haven't found anything else about if he'd had trophies from his other victims. So I think that he was definitely escalating. And he was so young at the time. I think he was 19 when they brought him in. And his he was active from August of 76 to spring of 77. So he definitely, it escalated very quickly. I don't think, no two of them are exactly the same, which is also telling. So like I said, I couldn't really find, you know, just a wellspring of information on him. But I did find a really interesting article from the Washington Post back in February of 78. So he would have been in jail for a little less than a year. And sorry, the link I had to, it's not working. Give me just one second. And I'm not going to read the whole thing, but there are some really interesting parts I want to cover. Basically, the article
in the show notes too.
Oh, okay. It is about how he wrote a book while he was behind bars. It's called The Trials and Tribulations of Monty Russell. And apparently it is a tell-all about his crimes. It also prompted the Virginia legislature to, I believe, pass a bill similar to the one they had in New York, the Son of Sam bill, that doesn't allow criminals to profit from their crimes while behind bars. So what's interesting in this article is he actually gets advice from a local sheriff about editing the book. But then with this bill, this legislation that they're trying to pass, all of the money would go to like victims' rights organizations.
So was the sheriff adding, like, helping him about writing so he can still appeal, so he doesn't like overshare? Like, it's not like an OJ, if I did it, this is how I do it? Or was it more a confessional?
No, I don't. I think it was a confessional. Him literally writing a manifesto, an autobiography. I think attention seeking, and I guess the only appeal part of it is that in the book it does. He claims to be reborn in jail as a Christian. That he had problems with drugs and alcohol, and that's what led him to commit these crimes.
So is he a psychopath? Is he just saying, like, is he a H.H. Holmes? He wants to commit this.
I think he was definitely a troubled young man. One interesting thing in the article, I'm just going to read this verbatim. It says, the book lacks proper grammar, spelling, and sentence structure, although he attempts sophisticated prose. Quote, it was in the late evening, August 14th. It was cool and breezy out. About 9 o'clock at night, Rissell begins the book, setting the tone for the first murder. It was written on yellow legal paper. The manuscript is a culmination of 6 months of work while in jail, Rissell said. The inmate said he wrote the book from about 4 p.m. until 10 p.m. each night, using the pillow in his cell and a photo album as a desk. He became an avid reader of adventure books to, quote, see how words and phrases and sentences are used to get intensity or depth of it.
Jesus Christ.
He rewrote four chapters four times because he wasn't satisfied with them, Rissell said. And after his first draft, he rewrote the whole book on the advice of the Fairfax County deputy, Alan Fernandez, who told him to try to grip the readers at the beginning of the book. He said, according to the deputy, I told him in writing the book, he should start with details to grab the reader's interest, Fernandez said in a telephone interview. I gave him the example of the book Jaws. Like in Jaws, I told him to find that to find items that would keep you continuing through the book, like when Jaws attacked. Readers, especially in this area, would have interest in the book, and I think a publisher should have no problem, Fernandez said. In the foreword, Rissell said he wrote the book so that he could possibly prevent others from following his path. But he said he is also looking at financial rewards. Rissell said his book is published. Part of the earnings will go to victim's family, and the rest will be placed into account until I get out.
Jesus.
Quote, so I can start my life right. Rissell would have been eligible for parole 20 years after that.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and so I actually just decided to come in cold, and I haven't tried to look up the book. I'm not sure if I would feel comfortable purchasing it. I did, and I felt like it was such an OJ if I did
so
it.
Who gets the profits from it now? Does it still go to him or his family or something?
See, and I don't know. And I do want to kind of look into it more and see what else I can find, because now I'm just kind of fascinated.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, there's so little out there. It makes me wonder kind of why. And I just, now I want to dive into this wormhole with him, but it struck me as such an if I did it thing. And I refused to spend money, but I was curious to take a look. So I found it in a local library and read parts of that.
The library bought it. Holy shit.
The library had a copy donated to them, they said, because I took the book up to the counter. I asked them, did you purchase this book with my tax dollars? And they said, no, it was donated. They said, we are actually in their city. They were forbidden to purchase it. And there was actually, she said, it probably won't be here for very long because people are moving it to ban it from our library.
Wow.
I mean, I don't think you should ban it. Once they have it, surely it's useful information for people to read.
For sure.
I don't think books should be banned. You know what I mean? I don't think any books should be banned, but yeah, definitely, you know, no, like the Brown family sued him and I'm pretty sure like almost all the money actually does go to them or something. Like they want on their civil suit.
Yeah, but that's for OJ. That's not for. Yeah. Exactly. So anyway, yeah. So that's interesting. So we should probably table maybe a deeper Ristle discussion until.
Oh my goodness! I feel all these guys. We could do this. Is just a taster episode, right? And they can follow up.
An amuse bouche. So
and that's serial killers. Yes.
And I was like, I'm not gonna overdo this. I'm gonna throw this out here, and I think it'll. Good.
Perfect.
Oh, that was fantastic. Thank you. That was really good.
Thanks, Anna. Thanks. So, Dana, I don't know if you want to speak to this or want to, but Hannah said that his behavior escalated. Do you think he was decompensating or that he was truly trying to become more violent during out, like as his rapes and murders progressed?
Incredibly not qualified to answer that question.
Well, you're on the podcast, so you are qualified.
Yeah, okay. I feel really bad. It looks like all my lecturers are going to never hear this, so it doesn't matter. Excellent. So what I think is happening is he's enjoying it more and more. You do see an escalation, like Dharma escalated pretty quickly. Like the first couple of murders and rapes, it tends to be over quite quickly, and they do need a couple to get a good fantasy acting out thing happening. Signature, there we go, sorry. So he was developing it. He started young. He would have kept doing it. I want to say the Night Stalker in California. What did he do? He broke into old women's houses, raped them, and then strangled them with their bras. But the first couple he didn't strangle with their bras. It takes time to kind of develop that, so he just would have got worse and would have kept doing it. But he definitely, if we're using the definitions set out by Douglas that they were developing at the time, like the organized disorganized, he definitely fits within the disorganized, you know, the low intelligence, low amount of schooling. That work is just, yeah,
he seems to be more spontaneous, where somebody like Dennis Rader I think was turning it over in his mind probably for years and years and years before he actually acted.
Agree.
Yeah, and who wouldn't know, like, with Ristle, like, I keep going back to Dharma because he started quite young. I think his first murder was at 17 as well. But it wasn't until he was in his mid-20s that he really hit his stride. I should not say that way. Sorry. that he had a system worked out and a fantasy worked out. And the first couple of murders were, you know, there was a lot of experimenting. There was a lot of drilling holes in people's head and putting in drain killer.
Oh, yeah, to make sex zombies. But, I mean, we could talk about Dahmer, like, on another cast.
Yeah, I was just using his example because, yeah.
I totally understand. Me, personally, I find it very interesting. I find him that he's a serial killer by dumb luck because he should have been arrested so many times, but because of homophobia and just stupid police work. He wasn't. So when they're building like this profile and they see this guy starting really young and then experimenting, like how do you think that works as they try to project other people, or when they even use it in the series and say, well, did he, this guy have like an abusive relationship at home? Was he experimenting on like animals or something before?
Yeah, they extrapolate it. Essentially, he's a really good example of abusive home life. Ristle, like his father was just a piece of shit, from what I remember. So with the disorganized and organized system that they worked out, you not only have the murderer's characteristics, but you also have the crime scene characteristics. And Ristle, because of the way he dumped his bodies, they were able to infer back from that what his personality type fitted in to, like, the organized disorder, like, person profile fit into. Mm-hmm. But especially just the way that he treated the women and left them there, you would be able to... Yeah, I don't know how they do ages because that's quite difficult, because I haven't read that much about
being able to determine ages with murderers, but hey, most FBI profiles come up with white male between the ages of 18 and 35, and that tends to be correct.
Sure. It's the demographic that literally has the most power in the United States. Thomas, did you want to say something?
I can if you want. If you're down, I can.
It looked like your little speaking was ring turned on.
I'm sorry. I would just say I think in the show it is an interesting thing they bring up about escalation and whether serial killers are born or are they made, and at what points in their kind of younger lives is there intervention possible, even to kind of curtail this activity, or is it just going to escalate continually regardless of anything we do? I mean, you see a lot of these people are do have juvenile records and are either psychologically or in criminal justice are met at a relatively young age, and their ability to manipulate the system and still get out and then continue on the process of becoming murderers and rapists. And I think the show is raising interesting questions about that, whether there is anywhere where we can stop these people before they become.
Right. And now you're getting into like a Minority Report-y kind of stuff, right? Like, you know, just because they exhibit the behaviors, you know, can we, you know, keep an eye on them? I mean, me personally, I went to high school with a couple of kids that were just the weirdos that we knew that they did stuff with, like, you know, they like to go hunting a little too much and, like, you know, they enjoyed the field process. And they're normal people so far that I know. They're just, they've always just been that kind of weird person. Like, I don't know, like, they enjoyed that process of field dressing a little too much. But
yeah, I mean, there is hunting.
Yeah.
And then there is cruelty to animals, there is arson, there are things I think you can kind of identify if you see more than one of them in someone at a young age. That, and then what do you do once you do identify a person as a risk, I guess, is a question. Do you just medicate the crap out of them, or do you just, what can we do, if anything? Because I think a lot of these people are recognizable as a young age. Again, you don't want to take a person that's just slightly strange and destroy their lives. But at the same time, you don't want to know someone is a risk and then just turn them loose on innocent people. So
cue the Volk Clockwork Orange reread and DVD commentary episode.
Did you guys do one?
Well,
how long ago was that? Jesus.
No, we haven't. I'm saying we probably should, because that exactly speaks to this point, that if you know someone is criminal, can you, should you sort of torture them into not being criminal? And in Clockwork Orange, they do successfully do that. But how far have you created someone who is still a human? And is it morally right? And should society tolerate some low-level kind of proportion of violence? Because we appreciate free will and we don't want to over-medicalize people who have a percentage chance of doing something evil. So,
Let's just do the purge.
I mean, I think it's like in the show, though, where it says...
One at a time.
What are you, the... In the show, he goes, what are you, the mind police? You know what I mean? It's like, we can't... You get into, like, a Minority Report thing where when you try to preemptively strike against these people, it's... You can't institutionalize someone for not committing a crime.
Sure.
But more the point of their work is catching them immediately when they do surface, rather than, you know, like somebody like the Zodiac, who gets away with it, you know, who isn't caught or plows through half a dozen people or more before they're caught.
Ooh, you had creepy crows in the background there while you're saying that.
You're welcome. I hired them this morning to come in.
I was going to say Clockwork Orange is a really good example because the UK version had a 21st chapter where Alex is thinking maybe he would have just grown out of his violence anyway because it's a period of time is gone and he's thinking about kids and they'll probably be like him when they were a teenager, but they'll probably grow up to not care for violence like he has. And it's not the intervention that saved him, but getting a bit older. If you look at male populations, the whole idea of maturing out of high risk behavior between the ages of 18 and 25 is exactly that. The amount of kids that are criminals, like little juvie criminals, is very high, but you know, well, not high, but in that population, the amount of them that will go on to commit murder or serial murder are so low that it's not worth punishing the rest of them when they probably won't reoffend.
And that's exactly right, especially about the males. I feel like they're like reading into the psychology that goes into, especially when I say that serial killers seem to be a very American thing. It's like this toxic male masculinity thing, and why would, you know, so many of them be degraded by their mothers, you know, call them homosexuals or weirdos, or, you know, sexually abuse them and turn out to be that way. And I think it's almost like an inverse to this like American masculinity concept that we have that makes them act out. But
I mean, the only way to prevent serial murder would be creating this utopia where there is no poverty and where all parents raise their children in loving relationships, and then you're still going to get a kid that gets a really decent smack on the head to cause enough brain damage to the frontal lobe where they're no longer able to control their impulses and will kill someone. So I mean, you can't control for everything.
So is serial killing, it must be a combination of things, right? But is there do all serial killers have basically some kind of physical impairment to their brain that doesn't function in the normal way?
I don't think all of them.
So
that's what they're trying to do, is like psychologically profile, but I don't think that they all have traumatic brain injuries in their frontal cortex that makes them more impulse resistant or less resistant.
That's what Dr. Michael Stone's work is all about. Is he does brain scans as well as interviews, and he tries to test like nature versus nurture, so we can get into it more. I'd love to do one just on him, but he thinks it's a malformity physically in the brain, not necessarily genetic, but coupled with the nurture.
I would love to.
He's observed it several times.
So. And I think Thomas just posted an article about the psychopath gene, and it's like any other gene. Like if you're more susceptible to cancer and you smoke, then you're probably going to get cancer.
Yeah, I mean, it's neither nature nor nurture. It's got to be both. But I think if someone is a rapist or a murderer as a juvenile, I have a hard time letting them out. I don't know. I just feel like you're victimizing someone else when you shouldn't have to. I was an idiot in 1920. I'm sure most of us were.
I'm still a fucking idiot.
Yeah, I still am, but I didn't.
But I never raped and killed anyone.
I didn't hurt other people. And right. I think if you're a person, it's okay with physically hurting or killing another person. You know, I don't think you should get 3 strikes personally.
No,
and I'm not saying to kill them, but I think you're just asking for trouble.
I was saying before, like when you intervene, a Canadian psychiatrist, Elliot Baker, he tried to intervene with people that had committed violent crimes that were institutionalized. He gave them LSD, and they had weird naked parties and had to get food from tubes off the wall. And when it came to reoffending, they actually reoffended at a higher rate because
Thomas,
they said...
I brought him up during our Wormwood. He was the researcher at McGill.
Yeah, yeah. And they reoffended it at a higher rate because, as one of them said, he taught them to be better psychopaths because he taught them how to fake empathy. And when you talk about interventions, I mean, Kemper had a massive intervention, and all it did is teach him how to game the system.
Yeah.
The only thing I'd like to say about Speck is, because there's not that much on him, and I didn't have time to read a book, partly because I started reading Monsters of Florence because of Matt, is how far do you think he belongs in this set of people? Because he wasn't a serial killer. He just committed this one specific heinous act. And how far do you think when he got to that door, he knew he was going to rape and kill those women? Because up until that point, he was just basically a quite sort of, you know, petty crime, you know, sexually abusive. But I don't think there was much to prepare you for what he was about to do. And it just seems almost like this bizarre crime of opportunity. So I was just kind of interested, actually, from Dana, and also how you categorize him. And did those categories still get used, like organized versus disorganized? And all the stuff we're seeing here being set up, is that still existing?
Definitely, like, it's street killers do.
It's not the only way. They now look at it as four, and I am outside having a cigarette, so my notes aren't in front of me. So you have...
oh my god, I'm so jealous of you.
What was I saying? Oh, so you still have, like, serial and spree killers, and I do think Speck does come underneath the spree killing, because I don't think he knew what he was going to do when he opened that door. But Speck is really interesting, not only because of the crime that he committed, but what he did once he was in prison. I was a weird child who went through the crime library at the age of 14 and read everything, and my parents were quite worried. They realized I was reading all the psych profiles and not really enjoying all the murder stories. And Speck, I remember seeing on, maybe it was the FBI files, and they showed an interview that he did in prison where he'd had female hormones smuggled in, and he had the breasts.
Yeah, he grew breasts.
And wore little lacy underwear. And during that interview with a journalist, he performed fellatio on another prisoner.
I watched a video interview where he did it topless to have his breasts exposed. He had gynecomastia. And he chose to do it topless. Like,
yeah, no, it was the same interview that he performed fellatio, but the fellatio part was never on.
Oh, okay, I didn't see that.
Maybe he misinterpreted talking to the mic.
Oh, fuck.
Sorry, I'm fine.
Like, what a bizarre...
You have visionary killers who are told to do it by God. And then you have hedonistic killers that they mention very quickly. They call them lust killers. So that's a lot of people who kill their significant others and people who remind them of them. And, you know, they kill during sex.
Is that a serial killer, or is that those one-off ones where it's like the Craigslist, like,
no.
I want to be killed and eaten because that is sexually gratifying to me, whatever, like...
Like, you see them, like, their first murders tend to be someone who is attached to them, maybe an ex-girlfriend or someone that reminds them of an ex-girlfriend. It's where you have, like, really clear profiles sometimes. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, hedonistic killers, you have mission-oriented type, and I forget his name... he was in New York and he really wanted to shoot all black people, and he ended up dying of breast cancer at like 32 because he had the BRCA gene right after he was caught. Your masculinity and you got breast cancer. Anyway, and then you have power and control orientated, and those are those people that like to capture and torture. That's what they really get off on, and they really like
that. So
with
Speck, was he genuinely trans, or was he just doing...
Oh, no.
Doing it as a weird fetish or something? Because, I mean, that's, like, damaging for the trans community. I don't know, like, we have to be careful about that.
He's not trans at all.
So he just did it for shits and giggles. He just wanted boob.
He did it for power within the prison. He realized a lot of people wanted to play with boobs, and they didn't really care what head was on top.
That's hilarious.
Jeez.
Well, we should be careful.
I mean, that's fair.
That's kind of an important...
Yeah.
He was not trans. Yeah, that doesn't reflect on the trans
community
at all.
Yeah. He was not...
How did he get hormones? Is that legal? Would he have had to claim to be trans to get the hormones? Or
no,
were they just smuggled in?
Smuggled in. You can get heroin. It was the 90s, you know, 80s, 90s.
Yeah.
They could get heroin. He realized if they could get heroin, he could get female hormones.
Jesus. So what about displacement killers? As I'm trying to do a natural segue into Kemper.
Let's just go for Kemper. So you said displacement killers?
Yes.
As in... Sorry, you'll have to explain that one to me because I...
Oh. Well, okay. Why don't I just go into Kemper then?
Yeah, because Kemper, I think, actually has two types. He's a family murderer, which is a sign of a mass killing, like a spree murder when he killed his family members. But then by the time he gets out, he's a serial killer, and those two could almost be seen as two separate things, because his first crimes do not actually say much about his second crimes, I feel. But I his think, relationship I with his I mother think they does. Do.
I think the first crime does. Okay, so Ed Kemper. He was born December 18th, 48. 13-pound baby. His killings, as Dana just brought up, was between 60...
Sorry, Matt, just quickly. I can kind of understand why his mother hated him if he was 13 pounds.
Right. So his killings happened between 64 and 73, but as Dana said, the first killings were two in 64, and then his other killings started around 71-ish, I believe. 72 to 73, sorry. So he was born, and his childhood was pretty screwed up based on his own interviews. He was meant to sleep in the basement because his mother, whatever she was as an abusive alcoholic, was also concerned that he would hurt his sisters. So that he wanted to keep them separate. As a kid, they used to play fun games like gas chamber and electric chair, where they'd strap Ed down and he'd shake uncontrollably like he was being electrocuted, or grasp his throat uncontrollably and shake like he was getting choked out in a gas chamber. You guys played those, right?
I played lava on the floor, but other than that.
My next door neighbor hooked up a metal chair to the electrics box and tried to convince his sister to sit on it.
Holy shit.
Yeah. He didn't actually understand what would happen, and his parents caught him beforehand. Yeah. Smart kid, really liked electrics, went into something to do with computing.
Yeah, of course.
Brutos.
Yeah. So Kemper's father eventually left. Apparently his mother was unable to live with, and his mother often told Kemper that that he was just like his father, like whatever that meant, like she hated him, like whatever. So he ran away to his father's place, and his father was like remarried with a new family, and he sends him to the grandparents. So he lives there until he's about 16 years old, and his grandmother apparently is pretty abusive as well. And his grandfather is not. His grandfather actually buys him a 22 gauge rifle to hunt with, which he eventually shoots grandma with just to see, quote, just to see how it feels. Then his grandfather would return home, and Kemper, in apparently some empathy, thought that his grandfather would be mad about the whole killing of his wife. And so he killed him as well. For that, he was sent down to Atascadero State Hospital. One psychologist said that one psychologist Lund said that Kemper didn't kill the grandmother just because he wanted to see what it felt like. He wanted to actually test the level of pleasure it would get for him killing his own mother. So in 1969, he was released to his own mother. At this point, he's just kind of driving around in interviews based on a 1984 interview and 1991 interview is where I'm going to get this information from. He was just kind of driving around and almost practicing his killing. He didn't start killing. He started picking up hitchhikers. He'd drop them off. He'd see how far he could go with them as far as talking, as far as them trusting him. He spent years almost perfecting this killing, as he would say, to eventually happen to his mother. So in 1972, he did begin his killing. And at this time, he was around the University of...
It's a good school.
Yes. Is it Stanford? No.
Isn't that what Arizona State is called?
University of fuck? Okay, so he would pick up hitchhikers and bring him home. He was upset that he had missed... He was in prison during, like, this whole Summer of Love hippie movement, or so he says, that he didn't know how to grow up or how to act adult, so he wanted to pick up people and talk to them. And then 72, he was in Berkeley, and he picked up an 18-year-old Fresno State person, two students, actually. And in the years that followed, he would kill six co-eds, naming him the co-ed killer. And his murdering spree would end at, well, not spree, but serial, whatever, would end with the murder of his mother and her friend. He hit his mother with a claw hammer and decapitated her. And like what he did with most of his victims, quote, humiliated their corpse, which meant that he actually had sex with their corpse and their decapitated heads.
This is actually a really interesting subset of necrophilia. Instead of using the bodies as you would expect to, like using the holes that they already have, Kemper liked other holes that were created by mutilation.
Yeah. There's a nifty word that I never wanted to know called urmatio, which is forceful oral penetration, but not through the mouth.
They made a word for that?
Irumatio. During this time, Kemper is extremely intelligent. By all accounts, he's 145 IQ, although one psychiatrist thinks that he was even higher and he kept his IQ lower to be able to manipulate and change things as he will. And I'll go into this a little more as he changes things during interviews and kind of descriptions of what he was doing. But as a part of the manipulation, like I said, before he started actually killing, he would work with people, and even during his killings, he'd still pick up people and not kill them. And see, you'd say that, like, we'll see where they want to go, and if it brings them to their own murder, then it happens. But, you know, that night it didn't, and they're so lucky, because even though they told me to go this way, I said, well, if I bring you in his head, he's thought, if I bring you this way, it's the wrong way, and not only that, I'll murder you. But I know the right way to where you actually want to get to, and so it's totally fucked up. So, yeah, so he used to hang out, when the co-ed killings came up on the news, he used to hang out at this bar called the Jury Room, which was right across the courthouse from where all the cops that were investigating him would hang out. And he'd talk about stuff, and he'd learn stuff from TV where he's like, I can't go to any of the victims' funerals because I knew that, you know, they would look at all the attendees of the funerals and see, like, who shouldn't belong there. So I knew not to go to there. And he'd pick up stuff from the cops, and the cops even, like, knew him and would buy him drinks and called him Big Eddie. And even after he killed his mother and decapitated her, he made a phone call and said, I'm the co-ed killer that you're looking for. Like, and they dismissed him. He was like, oh, that's just Big Eddie playing a joke. So then he had to call multiple times telling very specific information that would be known only to the killer, to the cops. And eventually he was arrested. He was found guilty and charged with 8 murders. That'd be 6 co-eds. His mother and his mother's friend, because his record was expunged from the 2 previous murders of his grandparents. In the show, he comes across as completely intelligent, charming, very introspective. The 2 interviews that I saw of him, he's not charming, but he's very introspective. He's like, I know this is not right, and he knew that there's this rage in him all the time, and as far as displacement killing, he was practicing on the co-eds and everyone else to kill his mother, and that's why he called the cops afterwards to say that he had finally killed his mother. I'm done killing. You know, take me in. But still, like, in interviews, he'd be asked, like, what would you do if you saw a pretty girl? And he's like, well, you know, I'd think, like, you know, what would it be like if we dated? Or what it would be like if her head was on a spike? So I don't know if he would be truly done killing after his mother, but he did turn himself in. And that brings us to Mindhunter, where they interview him. And in the interviews that I saw, not in the show, was that he liked to play chess and like to play people. Like, obviously he was playing the cops at the Jury Room, I think he was playing the interviewees, one that was in 1984. He said, "Why did you decapitate the women?" And his answer was, "Well, when I was a kid, we had chickens, and my father had to watch, made me watch him decapitate two, and then my mother made me eat their heads." And then in another interview in 1991, he describes himself at a magician show, and there's a fake guillotine, and a 16-year-old girl, you know, volunteers to go in and get her head chopped off or whatever. And he found that very so. Anyway, that's my thoughts on Ed Kemper. What do you guys think?
Yeah, it was very interesting. I thought Douglas in the actual book, I forget the exact words he uses, but he does refer to Kemper basically as his friend. They have an interesting relationship. He says basically when Kemper is at his most lucid, he realizes everything that he's done is wrong, and that he has no business being outside of prison ever. But both in reality, I guess, and in the TV show, that Douglas and Kemper have an interesting relationship.
Yeah, and I think that's based on Douglas being a member of the law enforcement community. Kemper kind of always wanted to be part of that and was too big to. He was 6'9 and like 290 when he was brought in. So he's a big dude.
Yeah, I in the TV show when he tells Ford's character that, and Ford's like, "Oh, you're probably too big to be a cop," or something like, and you just see that second of menace in him. Or do you think they were lying to me then, or something like when Kemper, and I really love the performance of the actor. I think he's just a comedian or something. I don't think he's really even a trained actor, but his performance is really excellent, and he just has that glimmer of menace at any given moment. It really adds a lot of tension to all the scenes.
Oh my god, when the actor touches what's his name, Jonathan Groff's chin, and is describing like how he would saw off someone's head, I'm like, this guy's getting his head ripped off. Like, this is like the action that finally, and it's just like, as we talked about in the beginning of the podcast, just that tension where it's just like, everything seems like cordial and fine, and I'm just waiting for him to fucking like rip the guy's head off. Because he's just huge, towering over.
Yeah.
And I think that seems fantastic. You can kind of get what he probably would have been like if you were one of the co-eds that hitchhiked with him that ended up murdered. You would have a very tall, kind of slightly odd, introspective person who was very nice, and then they would turn.
Well, that's what he was saying. He was developing that thing.
He
repeated like his practice of like, if he was going to pick up a hitchhiker, he would already figure out where they wanted to go. He'd be like looking at his watch, like, "Oh shit, you know what? I gotta be home in like 15 minutes. But where are you going?" And then he's just like, he's called himself like this huge dork that like these beautiful women that, you know, would just think were unassuming. Like he had to be at whatever menial job he had to be at, and he'd drive them wherever. And that's how he diffused any doubt of like his actual victims. But he had to practice that, and it took like a year.
Yeah. Yeah, he's playing with these violent sexual fantasies for a long time in his head, and I guess he's acting them out, and it's really hard.
Yeah, and I read differing accounts of like him burying animals alive when he was young. Like everything that kind of repeated was that they used to play like gas chamber and electric chair, which is deeply dark. But there was an article in the Telegraph when his last parole meeting came about. And his sisters still think that he's fine if he got out. And his stepbrother thinks that they'd probably have to arrest him because he'll kill him just because of what he did to the family. So, I don't know what relationship he had with his sisters that, like, turned so deep, like, and dark that he had to, like... He says in one interview, "They got to go to bed upstairs in the bedrooms in heaven, and I had to go to bed in the basement in hell."
Yeah, I mean, you don't want to make any excuses for him, but you see kind of time and time again, these people have really poor relationships with their parents, and their parents are doing horrible jobs of raising them, and it's no excuse for them as adults, but it's really sad on a lot of levels.
And he said the night that he killed his mother, he had come back, and, you know, she'd been drunk, and she's like, "What do you want to do, talk all night?" So I don't know what that meant. I don't think he knows what that meant, but that whatever that did drove him to put a claw hammer into her.
Yeah, they talk about in the show, they talk about stressors or triggers to this behavior, and there's no, I guess, in these people's mind, rhyme or reason how they react to certain things. They're just kind of broken inside, I think, and but these things do set them off, and it's impossible to predict what could be something bad. It could be something good, but, you know, you see with Rissell, you see with Kemper, you see them set off by things that normal people deal with in different ways.
But I think with the difference with Rissell and Kemper is that Kemper was very scared of getting caught. And there's a number of times where he says, like, shit, like, the girl's in the trunk, and I think I left my keys in the trunk. So what the fuck am I going to do now? And these are thoughts I has. Like, he's like, I'm such a dumb criminal. He has these weird thoughts like that, and they happen, like, all the time, where there's this, like, division of what he's done or what he's doing and real life. Like, he talks about, like, seeing a couple going out on a date, like, in his building while he's carrying up a woman, like, a woman's head in his camera bag. And it's just like, hey, how you doing? Oh, hey, how you doing? I could be going out with that girl right now, but instead I have a decapitated head in my bag that I'm gonna, you know, go abuse. It's very sick, and for my sick brain, it's very fascinating.
Yeah, he's a really compelling character in the TV show, and someone I knew very little about before the TV show. So,
yeah, and I'm concerned that, like, I did fall down a rabbit hole with him because of the TV show, and I'm concerned that, like, the actual brutality and, you know, awfulness of his murders will kind of be washed over, because he's really played by this big, lovable guy. And by all accounts, that's really how he is. You know, except to his victims.
But not just to his victims. Like, yes, he committed horrific, violent crimes against his victims. That's why they're his victims. But towards everyone in his life, he is so manipulative that I don't trust anything that he says. I think changes in his stories might seem like, oh, I remembered this thing that also might have contributed to decapitation, that also could be like, hey, if I tell you something, you might become interesting again, and that's what feeds me. And the manipulation of everyone around him, probably including his sisters, and I don't think he thought he would be in prison forever for the murders. I think for whatever reason he thought he would get out like he did the time before. He would have a little stay, you know, do 10-15 years, out again and murder.
It's interesting that he's denied his own parole hearings, though, because he doesn't think he can be out.
Did he think that at the time that he called up? It's
his most recent one was, I think,
oh, no, I meant when he called in and said, like, that the final time when he's like, here are all the horrific
things. Oh, no. I don't know, but I don't think so.
Yeah. He's interesting. I dated a guy that was 6'8", and he was, I'm only 5'3", and they're Jesus giants. Christ. And 6'9", and the weight on him is just, like, he's not just a tall, thin guy. Like, you know, Kemper was a brick shit house of a person, and yeah, just lifetime of learning how to manipulate people to make himself seem smaller and less threatening, so people don't start on you for fun, which is what the person I dated said you have to do a lot when you're tall is because people will see you in a bar and be a little bit drunk and think fighting you will be fun because you're so big. I feel like Kemper just had like a lifetime of practice and then actually went out and practiced. It's, yeah.
I mean,
he's fascinating.
The gay derogative F word was used by his mother a lot towards him. I don't know if that, you know, influence, like, maybe he was gay, all accounts, he was interested in women and having a nice life with, or I would say, like, if he had not done any of the murders, he was like, I'd be married with children right now, like, you know, have a nice wife and blah, blah, blah. But I wonder if, like, there was, like, you know, some kind of, like homosexual tendency that he was showing that his parents didn't approve of, or I don't know, like, or it, like, and that's why I'm so interested in when he's like, his mother left, or his father left his mother because his mother was unlivable, like, she was a heinous person, and she always said that he was just like his father. What was his father doing? By all accounts, he was really well educated. He was actually part of, like, nuclear tests. And
he got remarried and had more kids. Like, yeah. Was there absolutely nothing wrong with his father, and his mother just had deep issues towards men for whatever reason?
I don't know, but it's very interesting.
Yeah. Oh, before we wrap up, can we talk about a little bit of how good the series was at just dropping Dennis Rader? Radner?
So Radner,
it's confusing to me, but yeah.
So Radner, if you're listening to this podcast, you probably know who Dennis Radner is. If you're not, then I don't know why I'm explaining this to you. But he was a BTK killer, and they drop hints about him all through the first season. And he was the inspiration for Harris's Red Dragon, even though he was caught well beyond when that book was released. So yeah, like, what do you guys think? Is that going to be the big thing in season two? Because it does look, from what I can see online, it says season two will be about the Atlanta child murders.
Yeah, so I don't know what the timing.
Oh no, sorry, Thomas.
No, go ahead.
I think they're setting him up as his great white whale.
I mean, which is fair, because he did, while they're developing all these things, he was, you know, what, a Cub Scout leader, a leader in his church, like a good family man. Nothing that would, you know, give the, you know, secluded 18 to 35-year-old white man. He was very active in his community.
Yeah, I mean, he's going to be free for a long time, so it doesn't seem like it's going to, if the series just kind of naturally progresses to the early 80s in season two, that the Rader, the ADT serviceman from Kansas, as he's kind of credited in the show, is going to be really an issue for, that I'm aware of anyway, for Douglas and behavioral sciences for quite some time. So I don't know if they're just going to keep giving him little vignettes, or if it's going to morph into a large part of the show anytime soon.
I mean, I think he'll have to, right? Maybe that's a big gamble to assume that you'll get a season two or three, right?
Or maybe it's because he's a good example of everything that they're not talking about. Season one definitely focused on killers that came from broken homes and were broken people quite obviously, where, you know, BTK hidden plain sight for so long, even to the point where he could stop murdering, and maybe setting him up as almost like the antithesis, like this is the person they can't predict.
Yeah, it's kind of what they're not looking for, you know, it's kind of what they're not set up to deal with, I guess, in a lot of ways. So it'll be interesting. I guess, do we want to talk about Anna Torv just a little bit before we wrap up part one, if that's okay? Just a huge fan. Love the way she looks in the series. I think Hannah said something like, I wish I wrote down exactly what she said, but it's kind of like drab and bright at the same time. And that's kind of, it's just kind of the Wendy Carr character, I think, in a nutshell. Just kind of really kind of a muted performance, but really powerful.
I really liked her. That scene where she's like by herself and just pouring herself a glass of wine after work and doing all that, at no point do you feel sorry, because normally they frame single intelligent women who are not in, like, not married or anything like that, is this, you know, oh, look at the poor thing. She gave up her life for her job. And it's, you don't get that at all. It's like, no, she goes home, pours a glass of wine. This cat is a curiosity to her, and she is fantastic.
Yeah, she's in her new DC fucking digs where she's got a new headquarters.
Yeah, like, but she leaves, like, her life. She just leaves her life. And I do feel sorry for her, not because she's a woman, but I just feel there is kind of a loneliness to her, a kind of a disaffection with everyone else, and I don't know. I think it's a really great performance, and I don't feel pity for her or anything, but I do feel like there's a sadness to her, an emptiness to her.
Well, I think that's because she did give up her relationship, more or less. And meanwhile,
she just walked out the door. It's awesome, but
but she does have these two male people that she works with that are in relationships, you know, like
one. Yeah, I thought her relationship with the other professor was, she was just so different in those few scenes we had. It was really interesting, really good.
I love it. No point does she come across as like she needs to look after like Holden Ford as the younger one. She's very much the, you know, toughen up, get the job done. Can you please stick to the questions? We're trying to do research here.
Yeah, I did enjoy that part. It's like, don't ask these open-ended questions. We need...
But, we need comparable data.
Yeah. So, I mean, to be fair, I mean, that's why they still need people in the field to be able to know which questions to ask and which ones to be uniform, so they can, you know, put into this computational model that could maybe, you know, help predict or, you know, see trends that we can't see.
Oh, I agree. I just, what I meant is that the person spitting out the information probably shouldn't be human. You know, you still need people to collect data, and you still need people to some extent to interpret data, but you can't have people as the computers. And at this time, and for a decade and a half after, profilers were the computers. So it means that they selectively ignored information if it didn't fit however much they thought they didn't, that you can't train a person not to be biased.
Yeah, but there's still, like, the thing, like, gut instinct works and ego works against that. So there can be people that, like, just rub you the wrong way that no computer model would have ever picked up on. Like, say you're talking to Ed Kemper in his car and you weren't murdered, you'd still be like, oh, I don't know.
No, I get what you're saying. I get it. I just, it's all the people that you don't predict. I mentioned the Bernies before, but there were a couple that killed quite a few people. In the town, city that I live in, Perth, WA, and they soundproofed a room in the front of their house to torture women in. My mother knew someone who lived next door to them and had no idea, because they were so normal. And they didn't rub anyone up the wrong way. But then again, that's the BTK problem. Like, you know, you're never going to predict it. And on good serial killer news, you know, the Claremont serial killer got arrested so when I was growing up in the 90s, there was a serial killer who killed three young women in Claremont. They thought he was a taxi driver. His first murder was, I want to say, like 96, but they recently linked a home invasion and rape from the 80s, and they arrested him Christmas Eve 2015, and he was an engineer living in a nice-ish suburb with his, what's 14-year-old daughter or something like that. It was truly, yeah. But they got profilers in and all that kind of thing, and everyone that they thought it was, it definitely wasn't, and they never suspected him, and it was DNA that got him in the end. It's fascinating. He will one day may come to trial, but he's only being charged with two of the murders because they don't have the body for the third woman, Sarah. Huh. Sorry, reasons that I got into psych was because of this guy, and I keep looking at it like every week anyway.
Sure. I mean, I think at this time, forensics, certainly DNA didn't exist, but even forensics was just being worked out. So I think profiling should still be a tool, but it shouldn't be the only tool.
And a lot of profiling that they're showing in there is using forensics, you know, types of knots and that kind of thing. You just don't use a certain type of knot. The way that I would tie someone up is very different from the way that someone has used it, a sailing would tie someone up, I guess.
Yeah, that's one of the things with Jerry Brudos is kind of one of the things that does him in, is one of the knots that he uses.
Or someone who's really into macrame. Macrame? I forget how you say it. It was the 70s. Everyone was into it.
That's right. You wouldn't be able to exclude anyone if everyone was doing it.
Sorry. It's a bit ridiculous. And did everyone come out of this just kind of like wanting Holt McCallamy to be their Jiminy Cricket forever?
I don't understand the question, I guess. Is he...
Like your conscience, like you're like Jiminy Cricket, like, yeah. Just when you need him, just a tiny little, like, Holt McCallamy. Just be like, what should I do, Holt?
Yeah, I like that his character kind of defies your expectations a little bit of what you would expect from, like, the middle-aged military kind of white. He's not what you fully expect him to be, but at the same time, like in his relationship with his wife and stuff. I'm really looking forward to season two and hope. I really like these characters a lot and I find them very interesting. So
that's a very tough relationship.
See. Yeah. I just didn't predict like his family stuff at all. You just didn't see it. And I guess that's what makes it such a good reveal, but heartbreaking.
Oh my God. When his wife finds the photos, and he has to explain, like, you know.
Well, his kid finds him and shows him to the babysitter.
Oh, right.
They come home and he has a fight with his wife over it and stuff. And it's just, I don't know, it just feels very real. I mean, they're both good people, but they're just kind of in a troubled relationship.
I mean, isn't that the same as, a kid finding a doctor's surgical notes or, like, you know, something that's just inappropriate? And visually inappropriate.
He doesn't have, like Ford at least can talk to Debbie about all this stuff on some level, but you don't get the sense that Tench can talk to anyone else about it. He just instead he'll just drink.
Yeah. I think he's like that, like you said, like that old school kind of person that, you know, leaves work at work and comes home and is maybe a distant father figure, but doesn't regale you with the news of the day, whoever got carved up.
Yeah, you kind of get the feeling he doesn't want to poison the relationship with his wife with things that he has to do every day. Like, it's almost sacred to him, and home is his clean, healthy place. So though he has an office and looks at stuff, that he doesn't poison his relationship with his wife with, this is what I had to deal with today, honey. How was your day?
But is it very healthy? Because, I mean, they're dealing with stuff with their son.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't see it as healthy. Can I say healthy? I just meant...
Well, it's for him, that's the way he looks. Yeah. Exactly, yeah. Yeah, there's even the scene where...
I shouldn't have said clean and dirty because it makes it sound like it's wrong.
Even the scene where they wreck the car and they're in the bar afterwards and he can't even call his wife and tell her what happened because he's just going to lose his shit and he doesn't kind of ever want to. I feel like in front of his wife, he never kind of wants to lose that facade that he's in control of all this. And it's just, like you said, all the relationships are really not what you expect, I think, and very interesting. So,
I mean, he is very controlling and paternal, right?
Yeah, I kind of got out of that scene. Like, he didn't want to call his wife because he probably would cry. Like,
yeah, I think so, too.
He never wants to lose that facade, I think, that he's kind of masculine in control, but that really he's.
But I think
it's really gets to him.
It's also because his son's so vulnerable. Like he knows that like he has to provide, because his wife can't work with a son that like that, right?
Yeah, I don't know. Oh, yeah. Really go into whether she had a career before or not, or what the situation was.
Oh, it was pre-second wave feminism. She didn't have a career. Please. Sorry. Yeah, it's so hard, like, knowing how people with developmental disorders were treated in the 70s. You know, if they asked for help, there's a good chance that their child could be institutionalized.
Yeah, and I think it's a degree where it's just not applicable now. I think that probably people that had, like, ADHD, mild autism, stuff like that, were just really considered, like, just weirdo kids in class. And then people that, like, with deep developmental disorders were probably, like, were, you know, headed out of public school. But I don't know, like, what the range in between was.
It depends. If you had a child with mild autism, that which is what happens to a lot of females because they're socialized slightly different, they think that that could be why there's less females diagnosed with mild autism than males. But it's one theory. I'm not entirely sure. I do think it is definitely something that occurs more in male children.
So thank you everyone for joining us for Mindhunter Season 1. We'll be back to talk about Mindhunter Season 2 when that comes around. Maybe do a preview and go into more depth of the people that were interviewed during Season 1. Or whatever we decide that sounds good.
Thanks everyone.
Thank you.
And for Dina and Hannah, thank you.
Go.